So I first met the Dalai Lama in 1992. And the Dalai Lama asked me when I first met him, why couldn't we use the same tools of modern neuroscience that we were using to study anxiety and depression and stress and apply those tools to the study of positive qualities like kindness? And I made a commitment to the Dalai Lama in 1992 that I was going to do everything I could to put compassion in the crosshairs of modern science, that is, to put it on the map in a very major way.
Mine damer og herrer, her er endnu en kendskærning om hjernen.
Du lytter til en videnskab.dk-podcast, støttet af Lundbeck-fonden. Som I kan høre, har vi en amerikansk forsker med os i studiet i dag. Det er Richard Davidson, som er professor og hjerneforsker, og han er i København, fordi han skal holde et oplæg ved arrangementet Science and Cocktails.
Richard er venner med Dalai Lama. Han har udgivet en række bøger og forskningsartikler om meditation og mental trivsel. Og så har han engang scannet en flok munkes hjerner.
Alt det kan du høre om i dagens episode af Brainstorm. Jeg hedder Anne-Sophie Tingsted.
Og jeg hedder Nanna Elving Hansen. Velkommen til Brainstorm. I dag skal det handle om, hvordan meditation kan gøre din hjerne bedre til at håndtere modgang i livet. Og så skal vi også have ryddet op i myter og misforståelser om meditation.
Ja, meditation er hyped og lover rigtig meget. Så kan det holde, hvad det lover? Nu slår vi over i engelsk og snakker om det sammen med Richard Davidson. Richard Davidson, welcome to Brainstorm.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Of course, we are very happy to have you here. And Richard Davidson, you are a professor of psychology and psychiatry, as well as a founder and leader of the Center of Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And you have dedicated at least 40 years of your research career to search for ways to enhance people's sense of well-being. For example, through meditation, which we will talk about today.
And we actually heard that you're a friend of Dalai Lama. And to my understanding, your first encounter with him played a part in your study of well-being. Could you tell us the story about that?
Sure. Yes, I'm happy to. So I first met the Dalai Lama in 1992. And at that time, I was mostly studying adversity. I was mostly studying the brain mechanisms that conferred vulnerability for depression and anxiety and stress-related disorders. And the Dalai Lama asked me when I first met him, why couldn't we use the same tools of modern neuroscience that we were using to study anxiety and depression and stress and apply those tools to the study of positive qualities like kindness and like compassion? And I didn't have a very good answer for him other than that it's hard. But it was hard when we first began to study anxiety and stress. And I made a commitment to the Dalai Lama in 1992 that I was going to do everything I could to put compassion in the crosshairs of modern science, that is, to put it on the map in a very major way.
Over the course of your research career, especially within the last few years, societal focus on mental well-being has only grown. But still, well-being is a very broad term. So could you sort of tell us what does it mean for you to feel well?
So when it comes to well-being, we have delineated four components. We can think of these as skills, each of which can be nurtured, that are fundamental to well-being. The first one we call awareness. And awareness is where mindfulness would be. And it includes our capacity to voluntarily regulate our attention. Mm-hmm. And it also includes our capacity for self-awareness and also for what scientists call meta-awareness. Meta-awareness is the capacity to know what our minds are doing. Now, to some listeners, that may sound strange, Maybe people think they always know what their mind is doing, but I would ask listeners to consider times when they may have had this experience where they're reading a book and they may be reading each word on a page, and they may read one page and read a second page, and after a few minutes, they have no idea what they just read. Their mind is somewhere else. And that is an example, which I think many people have had, an example of not knowing what our mind is doing. But the moment we recognize it, that's a moment of meta-awareness. And that can actually be trained. And research shows that the more we exhibit this quality, the greater our capacity for well-being.
That's the first of the four components.
Yes.
Awareness.
Second component we call connection. And connection is about the skills that are important for healthy social relationships. Skills like appreciation and gratitude and kindness and compassion. And we know that those elements are crucial to well-being. And we know the opposite, loneliness, is actually deleterious. It has a negative impact on our well-being. And in fact, research shows that people who are moderately to severely lonely, that actually is a greater risk factor for premature mortality than is smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
Wow.
So, and there's very good hard-nosed research showing that.
Yeah.
And so social connection is really crucial. So that's the second component.
Connection, yeah.
Connection. The third component we call insight. And insight is about knowing ourselves. That is a curiosity-driven self-knowledge. And it's knowledge of the narrative that we all have in our mind. All of us have a narrative. We all have these thoughts and beliefs and expectations of ourselves. And we know that there are people at one end of a continuum who have a very negative narrative. They have negative beliefs about themselves. They have low expectations of themselves, low self-esteem. And we know that that's a prescription for depression. And what's really important for well-being initially is not so much changing the narrative, but it's changing our relationship to the narrative so that we can see the narrative for what it is. The narrative is a constellation of thoughts. And if we can see them as thoughts, we can get some distance from them and we are less hijacked by them. So that's the third component.
Yeah.
I've talked about awareness, connection, and insight.
Inside, yeah.
The fourth component is purpose. And purpose is about finding our sense of direction in life and clarifying our values. And it's not so much about finding something more purposeful to do, but how can we find meaning and purpose in that which we are already doing, even the pedestrian activities of daily life, the simple things of daily life.
What could that be, for example?
Like taking out the garbage, washing the dishes, cleaning your house. Can that be related to your deeply to your sense of purpose? And the answer is, of course it could be. It just requires a little bit of reframing. And that's something that can be learned. It's a simple skill that can be learned.
But one thing that I find very boring as a daily task is to clean, basically, like to do the dishes. I really don't like it. Could you give me an example of how I can reframe my mind to find meaning, to find purpose in
yes,
that?
Yes, easily. Do you live with anybody?
I do. I live with my boyfriend.
Okay. So the next time you are cleaning the dishes, do the following. Take 1 minute before you clean the dishes and reflect on how cleaning the dishes is beneficial, not just to you, but to your boyfriend. And it's contributing to the general upkeep of your home. And that it is an act of generosity for you to clean the dishes because you're helping not just yourself, but you're helping others. And also recognizing that when you're eating from dishes, you are not wasting paper and you're contributing to the environment by reusing the dishes, you can reflect on that. And also you can reflect on what are the dishes used for? They're used for you to eat. And you can reflect on all of the people that are important, that are really essential in bringing food to your table, and allow a sense of appreciation to naturally arise as you are washing the dishes.
Normally, I would think, well, I'm doing it for my boyfriend and for the house to stay clean, but you are taking it one step further by also referring to the environment and the people that have made my food.
Yes,
basically.
Exactly. So to now go back and answer your question, a person who has high levels of well-being, mm-hmm. is showing high levels of awareness, is feeling very connected to others and to their sense of place, has insight into the narrative that's going on in their mind, and has a strong sense of purpose.
And those are together the four pillars of well-being. As you said, awareness, connection, insight, and purpose. So basically now we have established that there's these four pillars of well-being, and they're all supported by science. And now there is another component that I would like to connect to well-being, if possible. Because one thing that we have been thinking about is, if you look at well-being from a lifetime perspective, there is bound to be ups and downs in life. Like there's going to be happy times where the well-being comes easily. But there's also going to be things that go wrong, like you lose your job, you get divorced, something happens, you're stressed at work, right? So I'm thinking, to what extent is well-being connected to being able to overcome those hardships that life throws at you, according to your research?
So one of the consequences of cultivating these skills of well-being is resilience. And resilience, from a scientific perspective, is defined to a large extent in how quickly we can recover from adversity. And we can measure in a very rigorous way scientifically how quickly it takes for a person to recover from adversity. And we've done experiments in the laboratory. We can measure this in the brain using MRI. We can measure it in the body, for example, with stress hormones, and looking to see how long it takes for those stress hormones to come back to baseline. We can measure it in changes in the autonomic nervous system, many different systems. And what we've discovered is that when we learn these simple skills of well-being, we're more resilient. We can actually come back down to baseline more quickly. So it's not as if we don't react. We do react. The skills of well-being do not produce emotional zombies. Hmm. We respond appropriately, but then we can come back down to baseline more quickly.
All right. So it's the ability to sort of like wind down from that experience of adversity, of hardship in life, where you are able to reset your nervous system or your mind, depending on how you measure it. You still sort of put your attention to whatever is happening, but then you are able to like, okay, I'm over it.
Exactly.
Is it also to an extent about that you experience the emotions more strongly when they are there? Does your research support that is also part of why you are able to wind down so quickly? Or is that a theory that you're working with, I'm wondering?
No, it's a fact. Let me give you an example. We did a very highly cited scientific study in the laboratory with long-term meditation practitioners who have been practicing these skills of well-being. And we challenged them with adversity that we can introduce in the laboratory. And what is a common adversity that everyone has experienced that we can safely use in the laboratory? We use pain. Everyone has had the experience of physical pain. We know what it is, and it's real. And we can use heat to generate, we used heat to create very realistic burning sensation, and it's really intense, but we can deliver it very safely. And so we did an experiment that's very simple. We give everyone an experience of this intense heat, so they have this pain experience. Then we bring them into the laboratory and bring them into the MRI scanner. And we tell them that when they hear a tone, beep, then they know in 10 seconds they're going to get zapped with this very painful stimulus. And then there's a period where there's a recovery, where nothing happens, and then another tone comes, and it will either signify that they're going to get an intense pain, or it'll signify that it'll just be warm, but not painful. So that's the experiment.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then we bring these experienced meditators in the laboratory, and also controls who are just learning to meditate, and their age and gender matched to the meditators. So what we see in the controls is that when you present the tone, beep, even though there's no painful stimulus, there's no heat, the brain reacts as if it were in pain. So it starts reacting immediately. Then when the pain comes on, the brain reacts more.
Hmm.
And then when the painful stimulus goes off, the brain continues to react, and it has a very, very slow recovery.
Okay.
With the meditators, the beep comes on.
Right.
And then nothing. There's no significant activation in any of the regions of the brain that are pain responsive. None. Zero. Then when the heat comes on, the painful stimulus comes on, there's a huge response. And to your question, it actually, in some areas of the brain, the response is actually significantly larger than in the controls. They show an even greater response. But then when the heat goes off, they come right back down to baseline immediately.
Right.
And that is the neural signature of resilience. So they show a big response that's appropriate, but they don't show any response in the anticipation period, and they have a very rapid recovery. That is how we can define resilience in neural terms.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So it's basically that you see even more electric activity in the brain, in your brain scans, when the actual pain stimulus is there, but then it goes right down in the case of the experienced meditators when that stimulus stops.
Exactly.
Basically.
Exactly.
So what you've been saying is that basically, your sense of well-being can be boosted if you stay focused on the things that matter, feel connected to other people, know the way your mind works, so have an insight into your mind, and have a purpose in life that makes your action feel meaningful. And the more you're able to train those abilities, the more you can sort of prime your mind to overcome hardship in life. And you can do that, among other things, with meditation, which we'll get into now.
Yes, so let's talk about meditation now, because Richard, you've done extensive research, you and your colleagues, on meditation as a method of promoting well-being. And you actually meditate yourself, right?
Yes, that's true.
Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, can meditation help us achieve this sense of well-being that we just talked about?
Yes, there is a wealth of scientific evidence now to show that simple practices of well-being can, simple practices of meditation can cultivate well-being.
Right. And one very remarkable thing that you have done, speaking of meditation, is to scan the brain of Tibetan monks. You have scanned their brains while they were meditating to try and understand the effect of meditation. So could you please share the story of how you came to put electrodes on the head of these monks and what the brain scans showed?
Yeah, I mean, the research that we've done with advanced Tibetan meditators is a direct outcome of our dialogues with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. In discussions with the Dalai Lama, we reasoned that this would be a reasonable place to start, because if we didn't see anything different about the brains of these people who've been meditating for decades, and you can think of them as professional meditators, that's what they do, tens of thousands of hours of practice. If we didn't see anything different in their brains, the likelihood of seeing differences in a more novice brain was going to be very low. So we needed to start there, not to end there, but to start there. So that's what we did. We started there, and sure enough, we in fact found that their brains were very different. They were so different that we can visually see in the raw signals, which is almost unheard of, we can see that they were different. And that gave us confidence that there was a there, that there was something going on in the brain that was quite interesting, that was associated with their meditation.
But what was it actually with the brain waves that were different than regular people, if you can say that?
Yeah, so the first observation was with brain electrical measures with EEG, and we saw very high amplitude gamma oscillations for a long period of time. And this is something extremely unusual. So most people, you and I, have gamma oscillations, but they're very short in duration typically. They're typically less than 1 second, and they occur sporadically. In these long-term practitioners, we saw these gamma oscillations going on for minutes, even longer. And in fact, they are prevalent in their baseline state when they're not meditating. We published some follow-up work a few years ago showing that these gamma oscillations are even present during sleep in these long-term meditators.
So the gamma waves, basically we all have different kinds of brain waves, right? We have alpha that some people might have heard of. We have delta and then gamma as well as others. And gamma is characterized with these sort of very spiky waves. And it's the brainwave frequency that is the fastest and occur when different brain regions are sending electronic signals at the same time. So in that way, I suppose it means that your brain is more synchronized when you have this sort of activity.
Yeah, they don't have to be highly synchronized. And in fact, when most people show gamma oscillations, they're not highly synchronized. But in these long-term practitioners, they are. And we think that this is a neural correlate of the phenomenological experience they have of having a panoramic awareness. For most people, most of the time, our awareness is pretty constricted. But in these long-term practitioners, their awareness is vast. And so right now, I'm talking to you, and I'm also attentive to what I'm saying. I'm also attentive to each of you. I can see your face. I can process that. But I'm also attentive to how my body is feeling. I can, in the background, feel my feet that are grounded on the floor.
So what can these high-frequency GABA waves tell us about well-being? You were talking about that the perspective is broadened, but how do we know that that is linked to well-being?
So that's an important question. And the way we know that gamma oscillations are linked to well-being, first of all, is in research that finds that meditators who are showing these high-amplitude gamma oscillations report higher levels of well-being than most other people. And then on measures of resilience, for example, on their ability to recover from adversity, they do better. On measures that are monitoring, for example, stress hormones, they do better. So on a whole list of attributes that include both subjective measures as well as objective measures, they are showing a profile that is more consistent with well-being.
And maybe, and because that makes me think about the pain experiment you told about earlier, where the trained meditators, their brain didn't react when they were told they were going to have the pain, the sound, the beep sound you told about. And then they actually only reacted when they felt the pain. And then just as soon as the pain was over, the reaction in their brain, it just went away again. Mm-hmm. So they were kind of like in the moment. Like they were yes. experiencing the yes. pain in the moment. They weren't yes. experienced it before or after. So what does this experiment actually tell us about the meditation's ability to make us better at overcoming hardship?
Yeah. So you use the words being in the moment,
mm-hmm.
And this is something very important. Humans have a well-developed capacity, more than any other species, to do what scientists have called mental time travel. We can reflect on our past, and we can anticipate the future. And that obviously confers a lot of advantages to us as human beings, because we can harness insights from the past and plan for the future, which is very helpful. But that also can hijack our mind and our brain so that we're no longer living in the moment, but we're consumed by our thoughts of the past and our thoughts about the future rather than living in the present. And so this is something really important. And the skills of well-being that we're talking about provide a strategy for us to be able to live more in the moment while still enjoying the benefits of being able to plan for the future and reflect on the past.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Right. One thing I'm thinking about is we have been talking about this pain experiment, but I feel like one thing is meditation's ability to overcome sort of smaller issues such as temporary pain. But at your research center, the Center of Healthy Minds, you have also studied how meditation can improve the way we deal with more serious things. So is there evidence that meditation can shield our brain against mental illnesses such as depression, anxiety, and physical or neurological illnesses?
Yeah, meditation is not a panacea for everything. It won't cure all our illnesses. The Dalai Lama often jokes, you know, he has a lot of knee pain because he's been sitting cross-legged for more than 80 years, and it's taken a toll on his knees. And he said, if meditation was so good for our physical health, why does he still have knee pain? I mean, he's learned to live with it, but it's still painful. So it's not going to cure everything. But it can be very helpful for many different conditions, including depression and anxiety. And those issues are still being studied. But our conviction is by helping people nourish their strengths, nourish their innate capacity for well-being and flourishing, we can buffer people from more serious problems later on in particular. So we can use this preventatively. It may also be helpful in directly treating these disorders from a strength-based approach, where rather than treating the symptoms, what we do is we strengthen these innate qualities, which can really help buffer a person and decrease the severity of the symptoms. So, you know, when I was a student, I was taught to look at people and to try to figure out what's wrong with them. And now I look at people and I try to figure out what's right with them. Mm. It's a completely different orientation.
Right, right. You change the mindset. So it's not about treating the symptoms, as you say. It's not about treating the broken leg, but the way you look at the broken leg. In this last part of the interview, we would like to talk about how people, the listeners, can use meditation to feel better themselves. But first of all, I would like to clear up, because there's a bit of a division among scientists about meditation. Some think the idea of meditation increases well-being and has all of these positive effects that we have just talked about, right? There are several well-made studies that indicate that meditation does come with health benefits. But there are also others that think that the effects are too hyped. I mean, it's a multi-billion dollar industry with workshops and books and so on. So I was wondering, have you also found like limits to what meditation can do in your own research, or so-called non-effects?
Yes. First, I agree with a lot of the critics about meditation being hyped. I think there is a lot of hype in the popular media, and it obscures the scientific facts and insights. So consumers need to navigate that, and it's complicated. With respect to our own scientific research, there have been many occasions where we have hypothesized that meditation would be beneficial for a certain kind of characteristic, and we did the research and we found that it wasn't. And we've published it. Where, even though, you know, I'm a meditator, I've been meditating for more than 40 years, I'm also committed to the truth. And so we need to publish what we find. And that will be helpful. It's not going to diminish, I think, a person's interest in meditating, but it will help to sift what is real and what is not real in terms of the effects we can expect. So there are many things that we have studied, ranging from structural differences in the brain with short amounts of practice to interception, the ability to perceive bodily signals, that have been certainly hyped in the popular media and that we find very little evidence for in serious scientific research. And we've published on those things, and we will continue to publish those kind of papers. And, you know, those are some of the papers I'm most proud of from our center, because it underscores our commitment to doing this in a really honest way. We're meditators. We certainly believe in its value, but we also believe that there are limits to what meditation can do, and it's important to be truthful and honest about the science.
There's a reason for healthy skepticism, you can say.
Yes, I think there is absolutely a reason for healthy skepticism.
So we were wondering, actually, if I or Anne Sophia or the listeners would like to try and do meditation, where to start. Or we also have some questions about what is the right way to go about this.
Well, yeah, because I found these case reports describing how certain types of meditation, usually intensive meditation of many hours a day, seem to have led to, in the case of some individual, harmful effects, problems falling asleep, low mood, and in the more serious genre, hallucinations and delusions and perhaps even psychosis. So I guess my question is, do you think meditation is a one-size-fits-all when it comes to its positive effects on the mind, or are there some people that shouldn't meditate?
Yeah, so I'm certainly very well aware of those case reports. We ourselves have published research concerning possible harm in meditation, where we in fact did not find that it was harmful. We actually found that not meditating was more harmful than meditating. But it is the case that I think a person who has a premorbid history of psychiatric disorder needs to be needs to approach this topic very carefully. And my recommendation has always been that if someone with a serious psychiatric disorder wishes to meditate, someone with bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, for example, they should only meditate under the guidance of a mental health professional who also is a meditator. Unfortunately, there are not that many of those people, but there are some, and it's growing, and there are some here in Denmark. So I think that that's very important. And that will, I think, help to minimize the likelihood of any kind of serious harm. I think in the absence of a prior history of serious psychiatric disorder, either in themselves or their family, there's very little risk. Particularly if one starts very modestly. You don't start meditating by meditating 16 hours a day.
Right.
You start with very small chunks. And if you do it that way gradually, step by step, there really are very few side effects.
And what if you start feeling bad along the way? Should you keep going, or if you start feeling anxious and that feeling sort of takes root even though you continue? What I'm getting at is maybe you could have some sort of disposal for a mental illness that you don't know about.
Yeah, I mean, there are many issues here, and let me just talk about two of them or a few. One is that for a beginner who's just learning to meditate, it's actually common, and we've established this in serious research, it's common for you to become more anxious rather than less anxious initially. Mm-hmm. And the reason is very simple. For most people who've never meditated, if they begin to bring awareness to their own mind, they're freaked out. They realize how chaotic their mind is, how distracted they are. They just were not noticing that before, and that causes some anxiety. And they should be anxious.
Makes sense.
That's fun because I've tried to meditate before and I was like, oh, I'm so distracted. I keep thinking my mind keeps going everywhere. I can't do it.
But that's a good sign. That means you're doing it right. Oh, it's exactly right. So that's why we also recommend at the very beginning to do it in very small doses, really small, even just 1 or 2 minutes each time.
Right.
Very, very small.
And that's also what you're doing in your app, I know.
Yes.
That you have very short sessions of meditations. Very short. 4 or 8 minutes, something like that.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Exactly. And you do that, you can do that a few times a day, and you can slowly build up. But that's how you really begin in the most, I think, effective way possible. And also in a way that will really minimize the likelihood of any harm.
Mm. So your advice for people who would like to maybe start to meditate a bit would be to just take it slow a little bit at a time. But what should you do? Like, should I sit down and look at something? And or what would you do?
Well, with all due respect, I would, and not to toot our own horn, but I would recommend if they speak English to try the Healthy Minds program. It's freely available. It's totally free. There's no paywall, so none of us are making any money from this. We don't get a penny. But it is a comprehensive curriculum to train each of the 4 key elements of well-being: awareness, connection, insight, and purpose. And there are specific practices for each of them. And it takes you through step by step. So you can do a month-long program where you focus 1 week on awareness, 1 week on connection, 1 week on insight, and 1 week on purpose. And in 30 days, you can get a taste of the whole program. And then you can go more deeply.
All right. And is there any specific time of day, if we are really getting down to the detail, is there anything that is more effectful?
Yeah, I would say to choose whatever time of day is best for you, where you can do it every day. So if you reflect on your life and your lifestyle, what is the time of day where you're most likely to be able to devote, say, 5 minutes a day every single day without a break, where you do that for at least 30 days? If it's in the morning before you take a shower, wash up, that's great. If it's at lunchtime, That's great. If it's before you go to bed, that's fine. Whatever time you can do it, but do it at the same time each day on a regular basis. That's what's important. Mm. One of the things I often point out is that when human beings first evolved, none of us were brushing our teeth. And now virtually every person on the planet brushes their teeth. And when you think about it, it's actually kind of remarkable because this is not in our genome. We've figured out how to do this because it's important for our personal physical hygiene. And what the data show is that if we spend even as short a time each day as we spend brushing our teeth, nourishing our mind, this world would really be a different place, totally.
Let that be the last word. Meditation, as easy as brushing your teeth, and it makes you feel better. Richard Davidson, thank you so much for participating and sharing your knowledge on meditation and well-being. We're really happy to have had you here.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Når Nana så smuttede Richard ud af studiet her, og jeg synes virkelig, det var spændende at tale med ham.
Ja, det synes jeg helt sikkert også. Jeg er helt sikkert blevet klogere på, hvordan meditation ligesom kan måske hjælpe os med at håndtere modgang i livet, men også hvad det ikke kan.
Ja, helt sikkert. Ja, og det var jo også det, der var setup'et på den her episode, ikke? At vi skulle have ryddet op i myterne og misforståelserne om meditation, ikke også? Og det synes jeg, vi har gjort, fordi Richard siger jo, at hvis du har et meget skrøbeligt sind, hvis du har, han nævnte specifikke diagnoser, så bør du i hvert fald tale med din læge, inden du begynder at meditere, og du bør gøre det under vejledning. Og så siger han også det her med, at du skal altså ikke bare begynde at meditere 8 timer om dagen, fordi det er også sådan en myte, som jeg tit møder det her med, jamen, meditation er super godt, så altså, jo mere jo bedre, ikke?
Jo, og det var ligesom ikke hans pointe. Hans pointe var, at man netop skal tage udgangspunkt et eller andet sted i sin egen situation, ikke?
Ja.
Og så starte i det små. Altså helt som lille bitte, måske bare 30 sekunder, 1 minut. Og så gør det samme tidspunkt på dagen. Og så prøver at se, hvordan, altså sådan lige mærke efter, hvad det egentlig gør ved dig, ikke?
Præcis, og ja. Samtidig så har vi jo også fået etableret, hvad meditation faktisk kan. Mm. Det er selvfølgelig ikke en eksakt videnskab, og det er ikke fordi videnskaben er sådan et resultat med 2 fede streger under. Men der er i hvert fald meget forskelligartet forskning, der tyder på, at meditation er godt for dig og kan øge din mentale trivsel, ikke også? Og med disse ord, så synes jeg, vi skal til at lukke podcasten ned for i dag. Tilbage er der bare at sige, som altid, at I kan følge os på Instagram, hvor vi hedder brainstorm.podcast. Og så er der nogen, som Brainstorm er støttet af, nemlig
Lundbæk Fond.
Ja.
Og jeg hedder Nana Elving Hansen.
Og jeg hedder Anne-Sophie Tingsted. Tak fordi du lyttede med.